On December 1st, 2022, Olivia Truban, a communication PhD student at the University of Maryland, interviewed Dr. Peter M. Sandman on communicating about mass casualty events.
Talk me through your experience, whether that's, you know, consulting people on how to communicate about mass casualty events or just your experience communicating about crises in general. You know, how did you really become such a risk communication expert?
Well, this may or may not be responsive, but, you know, let me walk you rather than through my experience, through, you know, my model, if you will, or the principles that underlie my approach to risk communication, and how I see those applying to mass casualty events. Does that make sense, Olivia?
Absolutely.
So, some of this you may know, but I feel the need to say it anyway. The basics of my approach start with the distinction between what I call hazard and outrage. That is the distinction between how endangered people are and how upset they are. And leaving aside that both of those are difficult to measure, my model is grounded in thinking in a very elementary sense. We can think of it as a 2x2 table. Hazard is either high or low, and outrage is either high or low. It simplifies the fact that, you know, these are both at least interval scales and maybe ratio scales. You know, so that they're not dichotomous, but let's pretend they are. You know, so if hazard is high and outrage is also high, that is, if people are rightly upset about a risk that's genuinely serious, that's one kind of risk communication. And that's, you know, that's sort of classic crisis communication. People are in crisis, they know they're in crisis. And, you know, the job of risk communication is to help them bear how upsetting the situation is, help them bear the situation itself, guide them to make wise rather than unwise decisions about how to respond to the danger they face. So that's one kind of risk communication. A quite different kind of risk communication is if people are endangered, as they are in the first paradigm, but they don't feel endangered. They are, at least in your judgment, unduly apathetic. They're not taking the risk seriously enough. You know, so the hazard is high, but the outrage is low. And that's what I call precaution advocacy, where the job is essentially to get them more upset. They are insufficiently upset, and you want to get them more upset. Not for the hell of it, but so that they will take precautions, right, or demand precautions, or tolerate precautions. If, you know, if you're taking precautions, then you need them to be upset enough to allow you to take those precautions. You think, for example, about mask mandates, where you're not asking them to take the precaution, you're asking them to live with the precaution that you're choosing to take as a government. So that's a second kind of risk communication. The third is the mirror image of the second. If the hazard is low, or at least low enough that you think the outrage is excessive rather than insufficient. People are unduly upset about a hazard that you consider to be not necessarily trivial, but at least lower than they think it is. And, you know, that's what I call outrage management. It is, you know, the least traditional sort of risk communication. I mean, I think precaution advocacy and crisis communication, you know, go back to Aristotle. Arguably outrage management does too, but risk communicators traditionally have ignored the problem of how do you calm people down and focused much more on crisis communication and precaution advocacy. And I think I earned most of my reputation and most of my income in that neglected corner of the 2x2 table. The fourth corner, where hazard is low and outrage is also low, I have not found to be either intellectually interesting or profitable. What would you say to people? You know, congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. I think there's not much risk communication that's needed there, unless, of course, you anticipate that you're only there temporarily. If you're in a low hazard, low outrage situation, but the hurricane's moving up the coast, and it's going to be high hazard in a couple of days, then you have pre-crisis communication responsibilities. But if the hazard and outrage are both low and you have no reason to anticipate that they're going to get high, then risk communication is pretty unnecessary. So that's the model. Since you're an academic in training, I should say something that I don't always say when laying out this model, and that is to talk a little bit about its causal structure. The correlation between hazard and outrage is quite low, but the correlation between perceived hazard and outrage is quite high. In at least some of the studies that have been done, it's around 0.7, accounting for roughly half the variance. That's a good, strong correlation. So the question you ask when you've got a correlation that strong is what's the causal structure? Are people upset because they think something is dangerous, or do they think it's dangerous because they're upset? And that's an important question. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous, the solution is to convince them it's not dangerous. If they think it's dangerous because they're upset, the solution is to stop upsetting them. All that assumes that your judgment is that the hazard is small, but there's a parallel problem if you think the hazard is high. And the question is, why are they calm? And it raises the same issues of causality. And it turns out to be a cycle. There are arrows in both directions. The arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong. And the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is comparatively weak. So for the most part, it isn't true that people are upset because they think something is dangerous. It's much more true that people think it's dangerous because they're upset. And the same is the case on the other side of the scale. It's not for the most part true that people are calm because they think something isn't dangerous. It's much truer that they think it isn't dangerous because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception isn't the engine of outrage. An actual hazard isn't the engine of anything. It's obviously important for its own sake, but it's pretty independent of both of the other two variables in this system. The hazard is whatever it is, but the hazard perception is very largely a function of outrage. So if you want hazard perception to be raised, you have to get people more outraged, which is essentially the task of precaution advocacy. And if you want the hazard perception reduced, you have to get people less outraged, which is the task of outrage management. Does all that may all be review for you, or some of it may be new to you, but it's the basics. Does it make sense?
Absolutely. And I think you really touched on it where the outrage, the way I always interpreted it in part of your model is I always interpret it as the socially constructed portion of the risk. So it's not the physical hazard per se, but, they do those studies where, if there's a fire going on and no one else in the room pays any attention to it, how people respond to that versus if people jump out of their seats and start screaming. There's this social construction of fear and danger, and people kind of allude to this collectivist mindset with that. So that's always how I perceived outrage to be, which sounds like the cultural component that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that works. It certainly works in some situations. To be sure, outrage is socially constructed. It's not necessarily a socially constructed impression of the hazard. I can, for example, think that the plant manager of a factory that's in my neighborhood is an asshole and is dishonest and contemptuous and a real jerk. And that's not, none of that is fear, but it makes me inclined to overestimate the hazard posed by his emissions.
Right.
You know, so anger is a component of outrage, and anger is not socially constructed fear. It, you know, it is what it is.
Right.
But you know, I think, you know, the notion that outrage is the socially constructed part of risk is not crazy, and I think that works. I want to apply this to mass casualty events, but one thing I should probably just get on the record first is you may be in a different place on this hazard versus outrage map for the same situation for different audiences. So for example, if you're an industrial facility, you may be trying to persuade employees that the risk is greater than they think it is, so they'll wear their safety gear, while trying to persuade the neighbors that the risk is smaller than they think it is, so they won't try to shut down your factory. So you can be doing outrage management and precaution advocacy about the very same emissions with two different audiences. And it seems to me that turns out to be relevant, in some ways particularly relevant to mass casualty events, you start out by saying, okay, if the audience is, you know, if you're talking to people who are in the middle of a mass casualty event, they're facing a horrific natural disaster or a berserk, you know, mass shooter or a pandemic. That's pretty clearly going to be crisis communication. The situation is high hazard, high outrage. And, you know, when I started thinking about, you know, the questions you were going to be posing me, I thought, well, all right, mass casualty events, that's all crisis communication. But then I started thinking, okay, but what about people that you're urging to prepare for a mass casualty event? You want them to stockpile supplies against a possible natural disaster, or you want them to get vaccinated against a potential pandemic pathogen. Well, the pandemic is a mass casualty event and the natural disaster is a mass casualty event, but talking in advance about that mass casualty event, you may very well be doing precaution advocacy. There is a high hazard coming, or at least that may be coming, so that, you know, you consider the hazard component of the risk over time to be high, but it's not yet present and people are discounting the future, so it's a low outrage situation and you are facing a pretty daunting precaution advocacy task, to get people to make painful or expensive or unpleasant precautions against the hazard that is not yet imminent or visible or obvious. There the mass casualty event is going to precipitate a need for precaution advocacy. It's also the case when the mass casualty event happens, it happens to people, but it may seem to threaten people to whom it is not happening. And they may mistakenly worry that it's going to happen to them too. And this is certainly true of mass shootings. Somebody goes into a school or a post office or a building and kills 20 people, and that's a big deal for those 20 people. It's a big deal for anyone else who was in the building at the time, and it's probably not a big deal for anybody else. And it doesn't mean that My life is, you know, even if I live in that town, it, my risk is not appreciably higher than it was yesterday. But it might be a little bit higher because you worry about copycats. Or it might be a little bit lower because there's going to be a greater police presence. But basically, mass casualty event didn't put me at risk, but I'm likely to think it did, or I'm likely, even if I don't think it did, to feel it did. And my outrage, even if my outrage isn't so much fear, it's more anger at the shooter. It's depression at how awful this is and how depressing it is to watch the news coverage of this mass casualty event 24/7. So it may be fear, it may be misery. You may know the research that 9/11 precipitated, even in New York, more misery than fear. Even New Yorkers, if you ask them, were they upset about 9/11, said yes. And if you ask them, were they frightened? They said, a little maybe, but mostly I'm miserable. Mostly I'm depressed. Mostly this has made life less joyful for me. And that's a kind of outrage too. And it produces an overestimate of the hazard, just as fear does, even though it's completely independent of fear. So all of that is going to call for outrage management. You've got people who are upset, frightened or miserable or angry, and therefore overestimating their hazard. Outrage management is called for to try to get that under control. So it seems to me that mass casualty events fit all three of my paradigms, but not for different audiences or at different times. As I thought about this in advance, that's as far as I got. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to say that and then see where Olivia wants to take the conversation.
Well, great introduction. I think it's really interesting the way you broke it down, how mass casualty events in general, depending on not identifying the specific nature of them, could technically fall into all three of the different approaches or frameworks. Specifically, when it comes to events where people are physically harmed, so a mass shooting, what do you think, based on your experience and your expertise, what do you think the perceived difference is between a godlike event, for instance, a natural disaster, or a man-made or man-created physical hazard, like a mass shooting? What do you think is the general perception of the public when it comes to that outrage management? Do you think they tend to amplify the man-created events more, or do you think they tend to be, more accepting of man-generated events versus natural disasters?
Well, I mean, in my list of components of outrage, the distinction between natural and industrial risk is one of the components of outrage. When I list them, it's one of the 12, or on a larger list, one of the 20. It's not usually one of the biggies. More often than not, control and voluntariness and trust are among the components of outrage that I've articulated. Those three are more often than not the three biggest ones. But the distinction between a natural and an industrial risk is a real distinction. And I know for a shooter is neither natural nor industrial, but and I'm going to get to that in a minute. But, one of the early issues I worked on was radon in New Jersey. I don't know if you know anything about radon, but radon is a natural decay product of uranium in the soil. It rises through the rock and soil. If it rises into your house, into your home, it can concentrate indoors in a well insulated home. Radon is considered the number two cause of lung cancer in the United States after smoking. And the two, by the way, are synergistic. Radon, if you're a smoker, radon rides the smoke particles into your lungs, so that radon is actually much more dangerous to smokers and people who live with smokers than it is in a smoke-free household. None of which is relevant to the point I wanted to make, which is, I worked on natural radon and the problem was insufficient outrage. It was very hard to get people to take the risk seriously enough, to get them to test their homes, to get them to remediate their homes. It's very hard to get people worried about radon, in large measure because it was natural. But radon is also a decay product of mine tailings. In communities where mines have accumulated these huge gyp stacks, these huge stacks of mine tailings that are, a blight on the community, and they're ugly and they're obviously industrial and, there they are piled on the street corner or piled in front of the mine. Or in front of the facility property, and they are emitting radon, and it's the same damn radon. But suddenly, there's all the outrage you could possibly hope for, because it's this evil corporation that has generated the radon. So suddenly, it's not God's radon; it's Monsanto's radon, and there's no problem getting people to demand that it be remediated. I think natural risks tend to be low outrage, and human caused risks tend to be high outrage. Another variable that's relevant to this distinction is moral relevance. Risks that are morally neutral arouse less outrage than risks that are morally freighted, that are where it's not just dangerous, it's evil, I think that's a bigger factor actually than natural versus industrial. That if you can blame somebody, there's going to be a lot more outrage, and activists understand that. And activists spend most of their time when they're trying to arouse outrage, trying to identify villains and make as vivid as they can in the mind of the audience how evil the villain is. A mass shooting does that obviously for you. You don't have to work very hard to convince people that the shooter's a bad guy. So I think the outrage at the shooter makes you far likelier to take that risk seriously and take and even to take it too seriously. I mean, the same things that make you take it seriously enough make you take it too seriously. It's additive. I think that combination of it's not natural and it's morally relevant, it's a misbehavior, a horrible criminal behavior, that combination is very conducive to high outrage. I should add that it's not just whether the perpetrator is a bad guy, but whether the people responsible for managing the risk are bad guys. So, I mean, if you've got a natural risk and you're trying to arouse outrage about a natural risk so that people will take precautions, it's very helpful if you can say the government screwed it up.
Right.
The evil perpetrator, if there is no evil perpetrator, then you want an evil risk manager. If you're trying to exacerbate outrage, and if you're trying to mitigate outrage, it would be helpful if there's no bad actors. But if my client is a bad actor and my client has misbehaved, then we get into the dynamics of apology and the dynamics of acknowledging prior misbehavior and being willing to clean up one's act and asking for a second chance and all the things that, I tried to persuade clients to do when outrage is excessive. because they have misbehaved. So that, you know, I mean, I spent a lot of time on industrial emissions that are, you know, from a health point of view, benign, but they are nonetheless emissions, and they are emissions at the hands of a company that has misbehaved in a variety of ways. And, you know, I wind up saying to my client, you know, you're going to be very hard pressed to convince these people that your emissions aren't dangerous as long as they are convinced that you are evil. And you might need to clean up your act before you can explain to them that your emissions are benign.
Right. And, you know, kind of going to your point about morality within the situations, part of the way I structured the second half of my questions is actually focused on morality and ethics. And I think it's interesting that you talk about, you know, everyone's trying to pick a person to blame when it comes to these evil acts because they're so beyond our comprehension of what we consider to be normative behavior. When it comes to when mass casualty events occur, what information do you think organizations should prioritize in releasing to the public? So from a outrage perspective, you're trying to mitigate that outrage. What information do you think should be prioritized in the initial release to the public?
Well, I mean, buried in the question is that you're trying to mitigate the outrage, which, you know, which isn't obviously always true. I mean, the first thing that happens when mass casualty events occur is you're trying to protect people, give them the information they need to protect themselves or the information they need to tolerate your effort to protect them. As I said earlier, I mean, there are audiences that are not at risk that imagine they're at risk, and there you're trying to mitigate the outrage. But, you know, we don't want to slough over the fact that, you know, the first thing that happens with a mass casualty event is to try to protect people, and the outrage management that accompanies that effort is not trying to reduce their outrage, is trying to increase their outrage, or if it's already high enough, then to help them bear it and help them act wisely in the face of, you know, because outrage can often, outrage motivates precaution taking, but it doesn't necessarily motivate wise precaution taking. It can motivate, you know, horribly mistaken precaution taking. So, you know, you need to guide those people. But putting that aside and taking, you know, I'm assuming from your question that what you're interested in is, okay, there's a mass casualty event and a whole bunch of people have been shot or, you know, have died in some way. And you're talking to people who are actually not at risk, but they're very upset. Is that a fair frame for the question?
Yeah, that's a very fair frame.
Okay, then you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is, you need to validate that they're right to be upset. When people are upset, they need to know that the person trying to calm them down isn't telling them they're idiots to be upset. Of course you're upset. Anybody would be upset. This is frightening. This is terrifying. This is our worst dream. It's so easy for, you know, to be empathic for the people who were killed and to imagine that we were killed too. It's appropriate and right to ask yourself whether this risk threatens you also. That's not a dumb question. That's both a natural question and a useful question. Before you make any effort to calm people down, you tell them how smart they are to be upset.
Interesting.
That's absolutely a precondition to saying anything useful. Another thing I would do early on is I would try to help my audience distinguish how they feel from what they believe. I would validate that emotionally this is upsetting. It will be upsetting probably for some time to come. That's why people in this situation sometimes need therapy. You know, a lot of people will calm down on their own, but some people will not. Misery turns into depression. Fear turns into terror. Either one can turn into post-traumatic stress disorder that, you know, you may need help. That's why there are grief counselors in the world. You may or may not need help dealing with how you feel. And help is available because it's normal to feel horribly upset by what has happened in our community. Insofar as you can put that aside, try to make room in your mind for the knowledge that you're not actually at risk yourself. And that's hard to do. That's hard for everybody to do because, you know, there is a natural linkage between how we feel and what we think. And it's unnatural to unlink them, but it's useful to unlink them. When a feeling is normal, but leading to thoughts that are false, nobody should tell you to stop feeling what you're feeling, but it might be useful to stop thinking that what you're feeling means something it doesn't mean. My clients have trouble doing that. They don't, you know, but I think the audience doesn't have trouble understanding that if you explain it to them.
Right. And when, you know, kind of to that point, when you're trying to unlink the emotion with logic, do you feel like when you talk to your clients and stuff regarding just crises in general, do you feel like it helps to provide some sort of actionable message, some type of action they could undertake to understand the, you know, realistic perception or the reality of the potential hazard or risk?
Yeah. The term of art in psychology and in psychiatry is action binds anxiety. It's not that action makes you less upset. It makes it easier to bear how upset you are. Whenever people are outraged, I would want to offer them things to do so that they can better bear their outrage. Not because that will make them less outraged, but because that will make their outrage less hurtful to them and therefore less likely to lead them to do unwise things. If people are fearful, it is useful to give people precautions they can take, even if you think that their fear is unjustified. So I think, and this is not a mass casualty event, but when I worked with the electromagnetic field controversies where transmission lines are going through people's neighborhoods or, you know, a new transmission line or a cell tower is put up, you know, just outside their bedroom, and they think that they're going to get brain cancer or some kind of cancer from the EMFs emitted by this piece of hardware, it is very useful to say to people, here's what you can do to reduce your EMF exposure. You should also try to explain to people why you think their EMF exposure isn't a significant hazard, if you think it isn't. But offering them things they can do, even if you think those precautions are unnecessary, offering frightened people precautions is useful. Similarly, and maybe in terms of mass casualty events, more importantly, given that the main effect of mass casualty events on bystanders is misery more often than fear, offering people ways to be helpful is helpful. If you understand what I mean, but, there's evidence that people who gave blood in the days after 9/11 experienced less trauma. Now, the blood was not useful because sadly, there were very few people who needed blood after 9/11. They were either dead or fine, or had cancer decades later. But you know, there was not a desperate need in the hospitals for donated blood. It was nonetheless the case that people who gave blood felt better, coped better, slept better, recovered better. You know, so offering miserable people, misery being sort of empathy, you know, misery is essentially more empathy than you can easily endure. And, you know, being empathic for people who, you know, for victims is a good thing, but it makes you miserable if you have more empathy than you can cope with. Being able to do something for those victims makes the empathy more endurable and therefore makes it less miserable. So yeah, I would always, I did a lot of work on pandemics and, you know, long before COVID happened, you know, I was urging clients to plan for a pandemic volunteer corps of people who have recovered. As it turns out, as you know, COVID, you can get COVID again and again and again. So that would not have turned out to be useful. but everybody's model was flu. And you know, after you get a pandemic flu, you're probably going to be immune for the, you know, at least a good period of time until the flu virus has mutated enough to endanger you again. So I was very anxious to, you know, for in pandemic planning to have the planners plan for volunteers. And you know from earthquake research and other research that, you know, there's always a shitload of people who want to volunteer and the professionals hate it. And they don't want volunteers. They give me money, but stay away from my mass casualty event. I'm having a hard enough time as it is, and the last thing I want is you to come volunteer. And I totally understand that. It's very useful for the volunteers to volunteer. I think insofar as we can, we need to find things that empathic people can do in mass casualty events to bind their outrage, to help them bear their misery.
Absolutely. And I really love what you said about empathy in terms of empathy really driving misery. When it comes to, I know that you've been a consultant for, you're a very experienced consultant. When it comes to, you know, your advice and, you know, just your engagements with people and your experience, how do you help them to communicate ethically about crises or, you know, hazards of interest? Is there a certain ethical or moral compass you kind of try to instill in them?
I have two answers. Yes, but I almost never say so. That is, I have not found it useful. Well, let me put it a different way. The most effective way I have found to convince clients not to lie is to tell them they're going to get caught and crucified. That lying is going to backfire. There are too many people paying too close attention. You're in a crisis. You are already the bad guy. And nobody's going to cut you slack if you overstate how well you're responding or understate how responsible you are for what went wrong. You're going to get caught and you're going to reap the whirlwind. It's going to exacerbate the outrage that people who are trying to arouse outrage are allowed to exaggerate. People who are trying to alleviate outrage do not dare exaggerate because it'll backfire and it'll exacerbate the outrage. So, you know, Greenpeace gets to tell the corporation or gets to tell the world that the corporation is more evil than it really is. The corporation doesn't get to pretend that it's less evil than it really is because people will allow Greenpeace to be dishonest, and they will not allow the corporation to be dishonest. It's not because it's Greenpeace versus corporations. It's because you're allowed to exaggerate when you're trying to arouse alarm, and you're not allowed to exaggerate when you're trying to mitigate alarm. So, if a smoke alarm goes off and there's no fire, that's a pretty minor problem. If there's a fire and the smoke alarm doesn't go off, that's a major problem. So we calibrate smoke alarms to go off too often rather than too seldom. We similarly calibrate activists to go off too often rather than too seldom, and we don't mind. I wind up saying to my corporate clients, or I used to, I don't have any anymore, this week for the most part, I would say to my corporate clients, in a crisis, it is in your interest to be extraordinarily scrupulous about the truth. If anything, to overstate how serious the problem is, to overstate your role in it, you can come back later and say it's not as bad as we thought, and that's an easy adjustment. If you have to come back later and say it's worse than we pretended, you're going to be in deep shit. All of that could have been reframed as ethics, but I found it not useful to frame it as ethics. So I framed it as empirical evidence about what works and what backfires.
Yeah. And you also kind of framed it from a consequentialist perspective as well, just being like, look, this is what I suggest that you do. And if you don't do this and you end up getting caught, this is what you're going to have hell to pay.
Yeah.
But you're giving them autonomy.
They did not hire me as an ethical advisor, I actually tend toward a deontological approach to life. I'm not a consequentialist, but I am as a consultant.
And it's funny. I actually, I have just started to get into consulting. I am still brand new, but that's the exact way I see it is. Individually, it's easy to take on a deontological approach to life and have a normative duty. But when it comes to clients, you have to figure out where their value lies. And that's usually within the consequences of their actions. So it's interesting to hear that as a practitioner, that that's kind of how you, your history in advising clients.
Yes, very much so.
Very much. So when
I'm trying to think, have I ever said to a client, don't do this, even though it's going to work because it's wrong? And I think the answer is no. I don't think I've ever said to a client, you could get away with this and it's going to help your cause, but it's wrong. And even though it won't backfire, and even though I think you can get away with it, I think you shouldn't. It's not something I would say.
And that really echoes the sentiment of all the other previous participants where, initially I was asking a question to participants where, I asked, how do you prioritize ethics within your crisis communication about mass casualty events? Do you feel like there's discrepancies between your organization and your individual ethics? And pretty much unanimously across the board, they were saying, if you don't agree with the ethics of a workplace, you leave, or that's your duty to leave. So that seems to be the theme. I don't know if you disagree with that or if your experience has led you to see others in positions where they might not necessarily agree with leadership or the entity of interest, but they have a different way of doing things. But it seems like people now care about that corporate and personality fit more.
I think that's very complicated. I can certainly imagine, and I can construct scenarios where the honorable thing to do is to try to ameliorate the misbehavior of an evil client and not to leave. The last thing I would want is everybody in the Trump administration to have left because Trump was a bad guy.
Right.
And to have left him with no advisors other than people unwilling to challenge anything he had to say. So I think it is honorable to stay in a corrupt situation and try to make it less corrupt. It usually fails, and it you get smeared. I think it's honorable, but it's a bad gamble. There have been times I took that gamble, and there have been times that I didn't take that gamble. I have helped companies I thought were evil be less evil. I have walked away from companies I thought was evil, partly because I didn't think I could help them, but also because I thought even if I could help them, I was not willing to get to have my reputation damaged by working with them. I think it's a very rough situation. I have even, declined to help clients under circumstances where I thought the client was in the right, because I thought the client was in a broader context wrong, and I didn't want to be associated with it. An example will make that crystal clear. Smokers overestimate the extent to which smoking reduces their life expectancy. They don't underestimate it. They have, smokers think smoking is even worse for them than it actually is. That's a fact. All the data support that it takes X years off your life and you imagine it's going to take X plus Y. That's a useful thing for the tobacco industry. That was when the tobacco industry was defending the class action litigation. It would have been useful for the tobacco industry to have testimony to that fact, which is indeed a fact. And they asked me to testify to that fact, and I declined because I didn't want to help them even by telling the truth on their behalf.
Fascinating. I'm just internalizing that's kind of you speaking to your categorical imperative, where it's like, why would I help you achieve an overall positive consequence for you and get you off the hook if you technically do something that is holistically negative? That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't want to make that sound more virtuous than it was. I was mostly worried that I didn't want to be known as somebody who consults for the tobacco industry.
Oh, well, who does?
There's nothing virtuous about that. I mean, if I were a lawyer, I would feel like they're entitled to representation. Why shouldn't I feel that as a risk communication consultant?
So, and that kind of leads right next, that kind of leads into my next question for you, which is really about, how do you think practitioners, you've seen all the rights, all the wrongs in terms of, mitigating outrage, addressing public information needs. When it comes to crises, how should practitioners seek to craft messages that embody empathy or like genuine care for their audience? So for instance, if a mass casualty event were to occur, like the Wisconsin, the whole Daryl Brooks situation, driving a car into a parade and, just killing a lot of people. How do practitioners or organizations effectively convey empathy within their messages?
I mean, the interesting thing is that's not the way they see the problem. They see the problem as, how do I stay professional and not convey empathy?
Interesting.
I have spent a fair amount of time with clients saying, in outrage management, it's a different problem, but in crisis, in an actual crisis, my client is almost always genuinely feeling empathic for the victims. But they don't want to cry because that's not professional, and they don't want to communicate that they are feeling the same pain that their audience is feeling. So they wind up telling their audience not to feel that pain, which of course exacerbates the audience's outrage, empathy, pain, misery, all of the above. And, you know, mostly what I, you know, in crisis communication, mostly what you need to say to clients is let it show. You don't have to fake being human. You are human. You have to stop faking not being human.
Oh, I love that. Stop fake. So really displaying humanism within your messages.
Yeah, just stop faking it. You know, stop being stoic. And that's true in outrage management also, but I mean, it plays out a little bit differently. I remember one of the very most effective moments I could remember in contentious public hearings, and this was an EPA hearing, and you know, the EPA person was under attack by the community for having, you know, basically not done a good job of protecting the community from a Superfund site. So it was a public hearing run by EPA, and people were yelling and shouting and telling the hearing examiner how awful EPA's performance had been. And it had indeed been awful. And at some point, you know, she said to the group, I need to call an intermission. This is very hard for me to hear. The things you're telling me are hard to hear. You're right to tell me them, and I need to hear them, and I need to bring them back to my agency and report back to my agency. But you know, we've been going on for an hour, and I just need a couple of minutes to myself, to pull myself together before I can hear more. So if you don't mind, could you just let me disappear into the back of the room for a few minutes, and then I'll come back and we'll continue. And, you know, it's wow. Clear that she was near tears, and she, you know, and she let that show, or she couldn't not let that show, I don't know which, but it showed, and she walked away, and she came back a few minutes later and said, okay, let's continue. And the indictment was identical, but the tone was completely different. People had discovered that, you know, she's a person, and yes, EPA fucked up, but, you know, here's this, you know, mid-career EPA technical person. And you don't want to make her cry, and you don't want to make her miserable, and you don't want her not to be able to sleep tonight. So people framed exactly the same complaints much more kindly and much more compassionately. And she changed the whole tone of the meeting by letting her own humanity show. She didn't change the content. You know, they were mad at her. They were outraged. They continued to be outraged, but they couldn't act as if she were a faceless bureaucrat because she wasn't anymore.
Wow. So that's so powerful. So in a way, showing your humanity can almost provides an opportunity for, you know, if you are refraining your emotion and coming across too stoic, it could be used against you. And while humanity, sometimes people could say, you know, humanism can be used against you if you're too emotional. In certain situations, you're almost saying that showing raw emotion can be used to your advantage.
Yeah, I mean, not faking it, but letting it show, even anger. I mean, the way these controversies, the kind of controversy that I earned most of my living working on, the way it typically plays out is, you know, the organization tries to be professional, and professional means they don't let their emotions show, and they don't acknowledge the emotions of the public. And they keep saying, let's look at the data, and they keep saying, let's, you know, here's the evidence, and you know, so that they're being hyper rational. And the more upset they are and you know, it's natural to be upset. These people are accusing you of you know, they're questioning your integrity, they're questioning your competence, they're costing you millions of dollars. Of course you're upset, but you think you're supposed to not, you're supposed to look like you're not upset. So you're suppressing your own outrage, you're suppressing your own feelings, and you become hyper rational. That makes them all the angrier. So you get this battle of stereotypes, sort of the hysterical housewife versus the arrogant bureaucrat. And she's not hysterical and he's not arrogant, but he's hiding his emotion and that's exacerbating hers. And, you know, he was usually my client. So, I was saying, you know, you don't have to fake it. You just have to stop faking it.
Interesting. It's almost like a seesaw effect. Like the more you try to suppress your emotions, the more you're going to just outrage someone else's.
Exactly.